We're delighted to welcome you all on this brisk Wisconsin day, but especially delighted to welcome Green Lake High School students. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The Green Lake High School students are here with us with a program, national award-winning program, called Court with Class. Students from around the state are invited to come and join us for an oral argument, and if they accept the invitation, they're given the briefs that the council have submitted, and they may do a number of activities connected with this case. For any of you who wish, there is a summary of this case available from the marshal, and a copy can be obtained from her or from outside on the desk. In connection with the Court with Class program, a justice meets with the students at lunch after this case and discusses the procedures of the court, not the substance of the case we are about to hear. So let me introduce the court to you, and I'm going to start with the justice on my immediate right, Justice Wilcox. He is a student of the law, also a justice, and he will meet with the students after this case. To his right is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to Justice Crooks' right is Justice Patience Robinsack. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her left, Justice David Prosser, and on the far left, Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, we'll call our second case, 03-0457, Gregory Gottsacker versus Julie Monier. Arguing for Julie Monier et al. Is attorney Paul R. Erickson. Mr. Erickson.
May it please the court, counsel, good morning. I think even though it's perhaps not traditional, it is important to understand how we got to where we are in this case. The case was tried to the court in Sheboygan County, and quite frankly, at the time of trial, I thought we would be going in and proving up some money damages that Greg Gottsacker would be claiming, and that would be what the argument would be about. At the time of trial, the Respondents' Counsel decided, apparently strategically, to argue that instead of the transaction resulting in something being unfair, that the way the transaction came about was unfair, and requested that the transaction be reversed. To do that, to get to that point, they had to argue that my clients, Julie Monier and Paul Gottsacker, engaged in a conflict of interest and then persuaded the trial court that under Chapter 183, a conflict of interest precluded my clients from so acting. And they were successful. The Court of Appeals, reviewing the case, determined that the trial court erred in its interpretation of Chapter 183. And in particular, Section 183.04.02 precisely and expressly allows for members of an LLC who have a conflict of interest to act. And it qualifies that by saying if, in that circumstances, the members act and they have a conflict of interest, they should deal fairly with the LLC and the other member. So the issue, as I indicated before, that we were concentrating, I thought, at the time of trial, was one of economic fairness. Did the transaction at issue result in some economic harm to Mr. Gottsacker? And if so, how much did that add up to? And then under the remedy provided in that very same section, 183.04.02, my clients would have to disgorge some improper profit that they allegedly received. Well, we're before you today, and there is no evidence that the transaction occurred at a price that was unfair to Greg Gottsacker.
If I could, before we get to the fairness issue, how do we get to the transaction? As I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, on page 3 of your brief and page 4 of your opponent's brief, you both provide the members agreement as stating that Paul Gottsacker and Gregory Gottsacker collectively shall own a 50% interest in the capital, profits, and losses of a company and shall have 50% of the voting rights of the company. If this is a collective group here, unless, I want to make sure I get the right party, unless Gregory is involved as part of any transaction, how do you get an affirmative vote under 183.0404?
If you determine that by virtue of the language in the operating agreement or the members agreement, that the term collectively precludes my client Paul Gottsacker from voting his own interest in this LLC, then we don't. And that became an issue that was to some extent debated before the trial court. The Court of Appeals sidestepped it and assumed for purposes of its decision that each of the brothers owned a separate 25% interest. So there is an issue, if we get to that level, whether or not the term collectively indicates that Paul and Gregory own an indivisible individual interest that they cannot each vote their share of. And I do have comments on that, and we did brief that. The trial court, even though it wasn't critical to his decision, did make a comment that under a dictionary definition of the term collectively, that I'm not quoting from him, but he, I think, reached a result that that means that 50% interest is indivisible and neither brother individually can vote their share of that interest. I think under the very same dictionary definition that the trial court referred to, all the term collectively means is that between the two brothers, when you add their two interests together, it totals 50%. It's a sum of. For instance, there's seven of you on this bench collectively, but each of you can vote individually. And so that becomes kind of a battle of the dictionary, if you will. But I think
I think it's a little bit more than that, because if you look at item 4, Julie Monet shall own a 50% interest. So you've got two interests identified here in paragraph 4 and paragraph 5. Julie can't do this on her own. I think you would concede that. Is that correct? She needs more than 50% under the statute. Correct?
Yes.
All right. So if you've got 50% here and 50% here, and it's a collective part of this agreement, they're seeing this collectively together, unless Paul assents, am I getting the parties right? Unless Gregory assents, if you're assuming 25 and 25 here, how do you get the 26 for Paul to move on his own here? In other words, you still got the two of them together here as part of a collective agreement. I'm having trouble seeing how you get any of the Gottsackers to move without the assent of both of them.
If I'm understanding correctly, then within the 50% Gottsacker interest, where do you get 51% in order to vote that share?
Exactly.
Okay. Well, this is part of our debate, was what does that interest mean? What type of business entity is it? Is it a partnership? Because if it's a partnership, then they can each vote separately. Is it something else that I don't know exists? We know it's not a corporation. But we do know that historically, from the tax returns and other things, that they've treated this interest as separate 25% interest. They've taken distributions. The K-1s reflect that. The K-1s reflect that the share in the profit, the losses, the capital contributions, et cetera, each equal 25%.
Counsel, and if you finished with a question I didn't want.
Sure.
Okay. I want to follow up on what Justice Butler is talking about, but in a little different vein. Here we know that 183 under a limited liability corporation or the Wisconsin Limited Liability Corporation is a fairly new concept, I think, passed by the legislature in 1994 or thereabouts. And this is, I understand, some new concepts, but basically my question goes to this. You had three people involved in this LLC. Two of the three took the only asset of the LLC from New Jersey LLC and put it into 205 New Jersey LLC. Now, under the fairness doctrine of 183, there was no information given to the one person, as I understand it. And if I misstate this, you tell me. But Gregory Gottsacker did not know that there was a transfer. So say he had no one, he could say, no, I don't want you to, and then you could have acted under 183, because your document that you drafted, and you can have a separate document. But here, basically, you had a boilerplate, with the exception of how you distributed the 50% to Julie and 50% collectively to the Gottsacker brothers. Then you said 183 is the document. So what we as a court look at is 183. Do you disagree with that? Is there something else beside 183 we should be looking at here? When we look at the duty or the failure to inform, because basically that follows up with what Justice Butler is talking about. There was never any information given to Gregory about this transaction.
The issue of what entity owns 50% of the LLC may bring in other statutes into play depending on what the determination is made. There's never been a finding on that previously.
Yes, but
you know, we've argued before. If it's a partnership, then the partnership statute.
Well, we know it's not a partnership. It's an LLC. Clearly falls under 183.
Well, and I respectfully disagree with the idea that 50% interest owned by Gregory and Paul constitutes a separate LLC that they have some interest in. All it is titling. We're talking about the title of their 50% interest being held in two names.
But there are now two LLCs. One is 2005 New Jersey LLC that has the asset that New Jersey LLC had before. And the transfer was made by Julie primarily to, and then Paul and Julie to the new one. So what assets are left in the old LLC?
As a result of the transaction, and this comes back to my comment earlier about economic issues, the asset, while it may be real estate, the real asset to the LLC is the equity in the property. The value less than
you mean the $22,000?
Well, it's a total of $88,000.
Yes, but
$66,000 has gone to 2005.
So you're saying that the LLC is not merely a shell, as alleged by your opposing counsel?
I disagree that it's a shell. It exists to this day. It's held other real estate. It can hold real estate in the future. Yes. It's still holding $22,000, apparently. It's set up to do business for any purpose lawful under the Wisconsin.
Mr. Lyon, I understand. So you're saying that Paul and Julie are still in the old LLC?
Sure.
Okay. But the only asset they have is what? Is it $22,000?
The $22,000 that it remains of Greg's uncashed check or any future business that they decide to take over.
Does that make a lot of sense, counsel, to have the $22,000 that's given to Gregory, who didn't know about the transaction? This is an asset of the LLC also. And I'm just saying that there was no notice. So one party to this had no notice of this transaction at all.
Let me speak to this notice issue because I don't want to get mislead anyone. If you look under Section 183.0404, and this kind of goes to the heart of what we've briefed.
Right.
An LLC is meant to be a very informal entity. And if you look under Section 1 of 183.0404, it specifically allows for the members to vote, approve, or consent to transactions. And specifically under Sub A, there is no requirement of notice to Greg.
So
that allows for consent of the majority of the owners.
But that goes back to what Justice Butler is asking.
Right. And if there is an indivisible, if there's some entity that is owning 50% of the LLC, notice to Paul could be notice to Greg, depending on what that entity is. But we've never decided that.
I guess this is the trouble I'm having. I could easily read this membership. I think what you want us to do is read this membership agreement as stating Julie Monet shall own a 50% interest. Paul Gottsacker shall own a 25% interest. Gregory Gottsacker shall own a 25% interest. I think that's how you're reading the agreement. But as I see the agreement in both briefs, it says Paul Gottsacker and Gregory Gottsacker shall collectively own a 50% interest. I see those as two different things.
And the interpretation that we've used throughout has been that the term collectively in this context reflects the sum of the two ownership interests.
Well, but that's the issue, isn't it?
Sure.
Well, the issue is how do you read collectively? Mm-hmm. You're going to read it one way, opposing party's going to read it another way, and this court may have to make that decision.
Sure.
Do we have to in this case?
Well, if there is a concern about whether a majority consented to this transaction, apparently, then you do.
And why don't they have to? Why doesn't a majority have to consent?
They do. There's no dispute on that.
All right. So if the majority has to consent, we have to figure out what's a majority here.
True.
Majority is either Ms. Monier and one brother, or majority is Ms. Monier and two brothers.
Right?
And your position is it's held as tenants in common, in effect?
Well, it's unclear to me, and it's not been tried and decided as to what exactly that is.
I think that
the practice of these and the past experience within this very LLC indicates that these are two separate 25% interests.
All right. What is it you expect this court ultimately to do in this case? This is been tried on one theory, right?
Well, the plaintiffs at the trial court level pursued one theory. We put in evidence of our theory.
Right.
Now, your theory is simply that it could be done, and if there was an economic damage here, that it's clear that you can use the equity that was there, it's $88,000, and it was a fair distribution because you used the $510,000 original purchase price. There was no other valuation. You used the assessed valuation. You used the purchase price that you bought it for as the fair value of the property. So there was no independent valuation other than that.
There was no – well, there is other evidence. The assessed value is actually – lower.
Was $494,000. That's what it was, yes.
Right. It had gone down from the initial purchase.
Which was 700 some thousand. Right.
As I understand.
That's in 2 years or 2.5 years before.
As I understand page 29 of your brief, accepting the Court of Appeals interpretation of the law, you still think you should win because the plaintiffs didn't show unfairness. Is that right?
Well, the Court of Appeals has opened up a much bigger window as to how these things can be disputed.
They want independent evidence.
If we strictly look at fairness being an economic issue, given that this is a commercial transaction between sophisticated real estate people, then based on the evidence in the case, it was fair. There's no evidence to the contrary.
That's what I mean. So you even accepting the legal conclusion of the Court of Appeals, which you don't accept, you would win. Is that your position?
If we agree that the members owe a fiduciary duty to each
right.
other, the problem is that the Court of Appeals said that that requires the parties to vote fairly and doesn't
right.
look at the result.
Right.
So I'm looking more at the result.
I see.
I think you can unfairly reach a fair result. And the statute provides a very clear remedy. Quite frankly, it's overcomplicating something that is fairly simple. The statute actually anticipates parties with conflicts of interest. And it says, in that instance, we can come in and correct it by requiring parties to disgorge improper profits.
And you're not opposed to that. What you have concern about is putting the building back in the former original LLC and then having some type of revaluation. Is that what...
I'm not concerned about putting the building back
well,
in.
The problem is
we don't have any guidance going forward to figure out what's fair in terms of procedural issues.
You don't like
predictability.
You don't like the remedy here. The remedy that both had is that the building returns to the original LLC.
This is a concern I have. The Court of Appeals said you didn't list it, there's not a written contract, they went through some issues like that. Let's assume all of that was true, and we still get to the same result. The result is fair. Why are we focusing on the procedural issues when we know, and there's really no dispute, that the LLC is meant to be this informal? Section 183 of 404 specifically says you don't have to have meetings, you don't have to have
But the counsel, wouldn't it be, and doesn't it seem reasonable that the legislature and, let's say, the book that has been written on 183, which you referred to in your brief, where they talk about fair dealing and fiduciary requirements, that it would be, if this court were to put the stamp of approval on this, we're going to end up with many different lawsuits coming up here as to what is or isn't fair because of the lack of knowledge that is imported between the members of the LLC.
Under the Court of Appeals theory right now, there is going to be an ability for minority owners to control LLCs through litigation, just like you're saying. It's going to open the doors. There's going to be a lot of cases. Whereas if the economic remedy, which seems to be suggested by 183.0402, is enforced or endorsed by this court, instead of getting to this point where we have yet to hear Greg Gassacker say, you know, I lost $20,000. I should get $20,000 more than I did. That could have been dealt with at the trial court level very simply. It's done every day. We can put in evidence of the property. We don't have to list it to figure that out. We have appraisers who can testify. We can have witnesses come in if we need to. But why do the LLC members have to go through those unnecessary and formalistic things at the LLC level when the statute doesn't require it?
If I understand you correctly, even if notice were required, it's only relevant if the notice caused economic harm to Greg, and when he sued you and you had it before the trial court, it was his obligation to show that the lack of notice, A, prevented him from getting a fair value for the property or doing some other thing that impacted his pocketbook, correct?
Absolutely.
Okay,
absolutely.
And I look at the statute, and it gives the interest in an LLC by statute, which is what the parties agreed to be controlled on, as an interest in personal property. So Greg really doesn't have any interest in this real estate.
True.
Okay, so I have concerns about the remedy, because the remedy appears to give him an interest in real estate, where the statute says all he has is an interest in personal property, which goes back to your economic concerns that if we harmed him, tell us by how much and the court ought to order us to pay it, right? Okay. All right. I think I understand what you're saying.
And maybe it's overly simplistic, but it seems to be awfully easy to do and predictable. And there, on the voting issue, one should also look at 183.04.04.1a, because when you look at the exact language of that, if you are comparing Paul to Gregory's interest, it specifically tells you to look at what their relative contributions are. So I think this is also instructive as to how to consider their individual interests in that 50% share.
Right, and there's also case law, at least that I found when I was looking, though you didn't cite it, that says you can modify an operating agreement of an LLC orally or by course of dealing. So if you look at how they've been filing their K-1s, they've been filing them as a 25-25%.
Sure. And that's what we were arguing throughout, that the past practice of these brothers were to treat them as individual interests.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Erickson, there is a Uniform Limited Liability Company Act. Is the Wisconsin Act the same as, consistent with, or different from the Uniform Act?
Off the top of my head, I can't tell you the differences. There are differences. Some of the cases that around the country that we found that talk about the duties of the members, whether it's a fiduciary duty or not, the statutes in adopted the Uniform Code, and they were different than Wisconsin. So, but I think overall the theory behind the limited liability company law is consistent. And by that I mean that it's meant to be an informal process and easy to use and easy for members to comply with.
But are you saying that, as far as you know, any provisions of a uniform law implying any fiduciary responsibility are different from the Wisconsin Act?
Well, the concern I have is this idea about implying a fiduciary duty. There can be things that are similar to a fiduciary duty that are referenced as in Mr. I think it's Boucher's handbook. That doesn't make this relationship a fiduciary one. 20 years ago, I was before this court arguing whether or not a stockbroker has a fiduciary duty to a customer. And this court held and became the standard for the country that stockbrokers do not have such duties. Now the Court of Appeals has said that members in a limited liability company should have fiduciary duties, but there's no special circumstances. Why in this circumstance do we need to imply such a duty? And when you think of fiduciary duties, I think of very onerous duties. I think if the legislature wanted those duties, it wouldn't have to be implied, it would be expressed.
Counsel, the language of 183.04.02 indicates that every member shall hold as trustee for the limited liability company any improper personal profit derived by the member. Doesn't that language suggest a fiduciary duty? Hold as trustee?
We're talking about the constructive trust with respect to the equity
improperly,
in real estate.
Improperly arrived at.
I think the duties of a constructive trustee are much different than general restatement of trust type duties. That just means you got to hold on to them and disgorge them upon order of the court. And I realize the red light's on, but 183.04.02 sub 3 is very important because we're setting a minimum standard here. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Conway, representing Gregory Gottsacker and the New Jersey LLC.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's an honor and a privilege to again be before this court, and it's a matter, I believe, of great importance, not only to Gregory Gottsacker and his family who are here today, but also to all of the people of this state who consider themselves to be investors. When a person invests in a business such as this, they have the right to rely on the operating agreement being enforced, and they have the right to rely on the statutes that govern that entity be respected. And with all due respect to counsel, I still submit to this court that they just don't get it. I didn't hear one word from counsel about how this transaction was of any benefit whatsoever to the original New Jersey LLC. And the reason that we didn't hear about that is because it wasn't. And counsel went to the trial court thinking, maybe we cut the wrong size check to Gregory Gottsacker, we might have to adjust that. And they were surprised, he says, that they didn't understand that this case was really about conflicts of interest. The plaintiffs in this case are not just Gregory Gottsacker, but also New Jersey LLC. The relief sought in the trial court and what the trial was about was whether the sole asset of this entity was wrongfully and surreptitiously taken from it by two of its members.
But, Counselor, if I buy your argument, then the minority member can shut down any activity of any LLC because they could never sell his property without his consent, even if they sold it for five times what they sold it for in this transaction.
I absolutely disagree, Your Honor.
Well, how would that occur then?
Well, how could it, if it was in the best interest of the LLC to do this? That's one thing.
What is that interest that you're identifying?
Well, let's look at the facts of this case. The testimony is uncontroverted that this asset was purchased, and it was for the purpose of a long-term investment. It was 100% financed, and the idea was that over the years it would be rented out, that the tenant's rent would pay the taxes, the maintenance, and pay for the amortization of the mortgage, and provide income to the members. That was the purpose, according to Mr. Gottsacker, and his testimony is unrefuted. Now, what you're suggesting is that if there's going to be a change in direction in a limited liability company's philosophy, let's say they wanted to sell this building, and let's say they had a meeting, which they didn't have, but let's say that they did, and Julie wanted to sell it, and Paul wanted to sell it, and Greg didn't.
Right.
And we've cited the authority in our brief that if people own an interest in an LLC collectively, just like owning stock jointly, they have to vote it together or they don't vote it at all. If there's an impasse, if Greg won't allow Paul to vote their interest and Julie wants to sell it, they can't get the other 50%, the entity is deadlocked. There's a remedy in the statute.
We just dissolve the LLC.
That's
like
correct.
You dissolve a corporation.
That's
but I
correct.
Don't see where your client comes out any better off
well,
in that process, except it costs a lot more money and takes a lot more time and is much more formal.
I don't think it's going to take more money than we've already spent.
Well, I agree with that.
and that's why I think this is an extremely important case, because what they're doing here is trying to get through the back door, but they can't get through the front door. There was no deadlock. There was no dispute. There was no discussion about selling this property because it was commercially advantageous. The testimony is uncontroverted. The building was rented out. There was a tenant. It paid the rent. It paid the mortgage. It paid the taxes.
I want to go back to your first statement that there's nothing here to show that we're looking at the interest of the LLC. And let's just say that we decide that because the parties filed K-1s that showed 25% apiece, that they modified collective so that we understand it as the sum of rather than a joint interest.
All right.
And so you have the meeting, and 75% of the shares are voted in favor of selling it for $551,000. So then how is the interest of the LLC damaged by that? Can there be a prevention of that sale?
Sure, because the original LLC, I suppose philosophically we could say it was relieved of its debt because the mortgage went with the real estate,
right.
But the original LLC got absolutely nothing from this. Nothing.
Yeah,
it's an empty shell.
All right, but so in my example then, you could never sell the property.
Well, Your Honor, that's not true, because the only purpose here, there was no commercially reasonable purpose. All this is a shell game. It's a fraud. These people took this real estate and stuck it into a shell that only they control. The only purpose was to freeze out this man right here. That was the only purpose of this transaction.
But, you know, if this were a partnership rather than an LLC, it's done when folks say it's done, because you can't keep a partnership going under the law unless the partners agree to keep it going under the law.
That's
right. You have exactly the same result.
No, Your Honor.
Why we should have a different
result. With all due respect, you do not, because when you dissolve a partnership, you dissolve it. Everybody gets their share. You don't have two of the members leaving with all the marbles and the other guy getting a check for an arbitrary amount.
Well, I'm concerned about the amount. I think that that is a problem. But my concern is with trying to put the asset back into the LLC, because I don't see how it would be any different if they voted it, they had a meeting, and the result was exactly the same, unless your guy is harmed because he didn't get what he expected to get or should have had financially.
With all due respect, Justice Rubensack, I think you're missing the point.
Okay.
There was nothing wrong with the original LLC. It was working just fine. It was fulfilling its purpose.
75% of the people thought there was something wrong with it. Why did they have to keep participating?
Excuse me. The only thing they thought something was wrong with was Mr. Gottsacker personally. It had nothing to do with the operation of the LLC. Okay. That is the point.
You're saying they have no right to make a change if that's their reason?
Absolutely not.
Say that in Chapter 183?
Well, the rules are set forth in the statute.
I know. I can't find it. That's why.
Well, Justice Rubensack, if the seven members of this honorable court decided to go buy a building, and then each of you has an equal share, and the four people from Justice Abramson over to my right decided they didn't like everybody from Justice Wilcox over to you, they sit down, create a new LLC, and send the three of you a check and say, have a nice day. Is that okay?
I think it's okay if the amount is fair. If the amount is not fair, then I think it's wrong. And I have concerns about the amount, but I don't think they have to keep on being partners with us if they don't want to do it anymore. So, anyway, we just disagree. You go ahead and answer, Justice Wilcox.
No, I've
already lost this side of the table.
No. you hit the nail on the head, right?
I think the
problem, there are two problems that I see, and I'm not disagreeing with either counsel, but I'm raising this. It seems to me that if there's any fiduciary duty, whatever fairness means, there was a duty to notify. At least what I'm driving at is that your client either could have agreed or disagreed. In other words, if he disagreed, then they would know. But right now we're stuck with this. And I think that it's, I have to say I'm concerned about what opposing counsel is indicating, that, well, the freedom to operate, we're going to affect business in the state. But I can't see business in the state being affected if it's simply that all members of this LLC at least know what's going on. It seems to me that's fair. Now, that's where I'm coming from. Now, to answer Justice Robinson's concern, and I don't know how far you want to go, if you go back to there could be a, quote, court dissolution, I'm saying that that's what was allowed for under 183, that dissolution meaning that if there was a, quote, appraisal, if there was a sale, then it would be legitimate in the sense of saying that there was a valuation that somebody could put their finger on. I don't believe, and I agree with Justice Rubensack, that this LLC must keep this building, and you're not saying that.
Well, no, I'm not saying that, that they must keep it forever.
Well, if you are.
I mean, if the members agree that changes should be made.
But if the members disagree?
Well,
we're pretty sure that the members are going to disagree here. So what happens then? That's your question.
Yes, that's right.
Well, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it, Justice Wilcox. My client was never invited to a meeting. There was never a proposal made. There was never an arm's-length transaction. There was never an appraisal. Let me finish, please. What happened here was not a business transaction. It borders on theft.
Okay.
Now, if the trial court is affirmed, and I think it should be, that real estate will be back where it belongs. That real estate continues to function as it's supposed to. The LLC continues to function as it's supposed to. there'll be no grounds for dissolution. But if there's a members' meeting, and if the members, two of them, decide that they don't want this building anymore, that there's a commercially reasonable thing that should be done with it, and they're deadlocked on that, their remedy is in the statutes.
And that remedy is?
Dissolution.
That's what, and then what can happen?
Well, if it's dissolved, the formula for what happens is set forth in the statutes. All of the debts of the LLC are paid, and then the members receive essentially what's
left. Well, that basically means that the building will be sold because the debts can't be paid before they sell the building.
That's right.
One person is on the hook, so to speak, for the with the bank, as I understand it.
Well, Jim Lear has the guarantee.
Right, right. So until the building is sold. So what I'm getting at is that the ultimate solution, that if they don't agree, if the building, let's say we accept it, that the building comes back, is that you have a 183 dissolution, and then that means that the building is sold, or they can shortcut it by saying, all right, here we've appraised it, here's what it is, if you want out, you get this much money. Is that?
And that's what the statute provides for. And one of the hallmarks of the unfairness of this transaction was this all happened without any notice whatsoever.
That was the point I was getting at, is that from a fair dealing standpoint, and we are affecting, we're not just looking at this case. There, you know, this is going to affect what's going to happen in LLC businesses throughout the state for many years.
I couldn't agree with you more.
And we want to get it right. And we want to do what is in the best for all. And,
yep.
And the question that I had, and that's why I'm dealing with this notice, and you used the word surreptitious, which means they did it without any notice to him, and they did it in the dead of night, so to speak. But I'm not saying they did it that way, but there was no notice. At least
that's exactly what they did, Your Honor. I'm not sure it was at nighttime, but that's exactly what they did.
But the main issue is whether it answers Justice Rogensack's question, which is, well, how is this going to affect this entity, and how will they be able to operate when there is a dissenting member, not just this one, but in any other LLC?
Well, Justice Wilcox, I think the point that we're here to deal with is not really about the future of this one little LLC.
It's the future of LLCs in the state.
We should affirm the trial court. We should affirm the Court of Appeals, restore this property to the original LLC, and let these people, if they have a dispute, follow the proper procedures that are set forth in Chapter 183. The issue that I think that we're here to talk about today, besides this issue of collectively and what does that mean, the issue that I think we're here to talk about today is what is the appropriate procedure to follow if members of an LLC are going to be involved in a transaction that clearly involves a conflict of interest between the LLC and the other members. That's the issue.
Mr. Conway, a willful failure to deal fairly.
Yes.
Does that go, as Mr. Erickson has stated, to the result, or does that go to the process?
It goes to both, because in this case, the process involved no notice, no opportunity to be heard, no opportunity to seek court intervention before this happened. It also goes to the result, because as was noted by Justice Anderson in the Court of Appeals decision, one of the hallmarks of unfairness here was that it impaired the ability of the original LLC to carry on its business. It eviscerated it. It's gone. It's an empty shell.
Well, let's take the position, let's just vary the facts a bit. Instead of transferring this property to a new LLC, or to themselves individually, they transferred the property to a third party. Fair and square, arm's length dealing. So now this property, in the dead of night, without advising your client, is in a bona fide purchaser's hands, as I understand this law, because one has authority to sell for all of them, and the party here, the third party, doesn't know. All right. Now, what's the remedy?
Well, if it is an arm's length transaction and it's a bona fide transaction because the purchaser has no notice of any lack of authority of the member that actually signs the deed, the remedy for the person who feels that the transaction was ill-advised would be to seek damages.
Which relates to how much the LLC got for the transaction.
Correct.
So why shouldn't the remedy be the same whether it's an inside deal or an outside deal?
Well, because the conflict of interest rules are supposed to prevent the inside deal from happening. It's supposed to prevent the people who want to benefit themselves. It's supposed to prevent them from taking the assets for themselves and leaving the other member out in the cold.
Well, in my transaction with the third party, I mean, my deal is to get rid of Gregory. I mean, I'm willing to not have that property anymore, but I want him out of this LLC. I'm going to then organize another LLC without him, and my whole deal really is to, I'm going to take not losses, but at least I really wanted to operate this property, but I'm going to forego that. It's really a same conflict of interest.
Well,
cuts him out.
No, there's, well, but you know, they have two people they have to be fair with. They have to be fair to the original LLC, and in your example, they were, because it was a bona fide transaction, correct?
It was bona fide, but Gregory thinks they could have really gotten twice that if they had advertised it correctly, if they had put in a few $100 to make some cosmetic changes, and that they just settled out pretty quickly because they wanted
be done with it.
To be done with it, yeah.
Well, then Mr.
But it's a bona fide transaction,
well,
certainly within the range. You know, there's a wide range of fair market value, right?
Well, certainly.
Okay.
But
and they were in at the lower range.
Well, but keep in mind also, Justice Abrahamson, that not only would Gregory have a cause of action, he'd be entitled to bring a cause of action on behalf of the original LLC as well, if he felt that this transaction was so ill-advised that the LLC did not realize the proper benefit from it. And your example kind of stacks the deck on me a little bit because you've inserted the bona fide purchaser. Otherwise, we would seek to upset the transaction. There's no bona fide purchaser here.
Counsel, though, if you had a bona fide purchaser, as I read the Court of Appeals opinion,
right,
then that's okay. The Court of Appeals interpreted the statute as saying, when, contrary to the trial court, when you have a conflict of interest, you can still vote as long as you vote fairly. And they defined voting fairly here as ending up with an arm's length transaction, and this was not an arm's length transaction, so they held as a matter of law that it was not fair. That's the way I read the Court of Appeals opinion. Let me ask the first question. Do you read that Court of Appeals opinion in the same way?
I read it to the extent that you've just recited it that way, but the Court of Appeals also said that in addition to the unfairness element being a no arm's length transaction, there is also the unfairness element arising from the lack of notice to Mr. Gottsacker, and there's also the unfairness element because it impaired the original LLC's ability to continue on in business, and there's also an unfairness element as it relates to the improper gains that Julie Monnier and Paul Gottsacker obtained. She increased her equity to 60%, and Paul increased his to 40%.
So following up on Justice Wilcox's question, it could be inferred from his question that as long as you take care of the notice problem, lack of notice problem, you've cured the fairness problem. In other words, notice will mean fairness. Do you agree with that, or do you think fairness in your argument, as you set forth in your brief, encompasses much more than notice?
It's much more than that, because even though there is notice, if the transaction that's being proposed is unfair to the original limited liability company, notice isn't going to cure that. If there's notice given and it's not an arm's length transaction, notice isn't going to cure that either. These are all legs on the same stool, if you will, and just complying with one of these things isn't going to keep the stool from tipping over. You've got to have all the legs on it. And the Court of Appeals, again, said that it was no arm's-length transaction, no notice to the other member. It impaired the continuing ability of the LLC to operate, and it was unfair because the two members, the dissidents, if you will, obtained improper personal gains. And again, you know, these hypotheticals are interesting to talk about, but that's not what happened here. And, you know, if I offended the court with my 4-3 argument, I apologize, but that's literally what's going to happen.
Oh, you're right on.
But if this court says that this transaction that happened here is A-OK, we're basically saying that you as an investor in the state of Wisconsin, if you're a minority member, and you won't even be told this is going to happen, and you're going to get, instead of getting your K-1 at the end of the year showing your distribution from the LLC, you're going to get a check. And that can't be. That can't be fair. That can't be right. Because what the whole purpose of enacting the limited liability company statutes is to promote and encourage investment, not to promote selfish people's agendas.
The counsel, and I don't want to repeat, Justice Rogenczyk was saying, all right, on their K-1 and their previous dealing when they had the Wilson Street property, they reported on the K-1, and we're talking about what happened here, course of dealing,
sure.
That 25%, 25% course of dealing, and they, well, although there was notice, I guess the difference between the one and the other, that they all agreed on the Wilson Street property, and there was notice.
Yes.
And I saw that in the record.
Yes. And so I would analogize that, Justice Wilcock, to my wife and I owning 100 shares of IBM. And we decide for whatever reason to file separate tax returns and each claim half of the dividends on our tax returns. Now, does that mean that my wife can vote 50 of those shares her way at the IBM stockholders meeting and I can vote 50 my way at the IBM stockholders meeting? No, it doesn't. The law is clear that when you jointly own stock, the members have to agree on how to vote it or it doesn't get voted. And now we're back to the collectively argument again, but what I really wanted to talk about was the conflict of interest rule, and I think that the statute 183.04.02 is extremely important to the analysis, and I think that Justice Bradley touched on this in subsection 2 when she referred to the language there where it says that every member shall account to the company and hold as trustee any improper personal profit derived by that member or manager without the consent of a majority of the disinterested members. And then you look over in statute 183.04.04, and it talks about situations where members are precluded from voting. And it states that when you have a member who's precluded from voting, only those people who are disinterested essentially can vote in order to arrive at the 51% majority needed to carry on business. It's difficult. The statute doesn't take us exactly where we need to go. But if we look at these sections, it's implicit, I think, that if you have a conflict of interest, you probably shouldn't be voting. I mean, that's what a conflict of interest is. And this is the problem that we have with Judge Anderson's decision. He says it's okay to vote if you have a conflict of interest as long as you're fair. Well, what does that mean?
Yeah. Well, your position is regardless of whether there was in either case, it would not be fair. Is that?
That's correct. We think Judge Langhoff, our trial court judge in Sheboygan County, got it right. I think Judge Langhoff's ruling is correct, that if you are a member in an LLC and you are seeking to take some type of action that essentially boils down to self-dealing, you are precluded from voting. You can't vote to take an action like this when the only purpose is to hurt the existing LLC and the other member.
How can you, see, that gets back to what I think is one of the core difficulties here. How do you define the focus of dealing fairly? Is it not giving notice?
Well, it's certainly part of it. And here's how.
Excuse me, I haven't finished. Is it not giving notice? Is it dealing fairly mean a full or fair result? What if you, and these are all questions that have been asked, what if you deal unfairly but with a result have an arm's-length transaction, so the result is fair. And Justice Butler raised that from the get-go. So that, to me, that's real difficult in defining the focus that brings forth a violation of what does unfair dealing mean.
Well, fundamental fairness, I believe, means that you act while the horse is still in the barn. You don't do whatever the heck you want to do, send somebody a check, and then say, well, if they don't think the amount is right, we'll let them sue us. That's not fundamental fairness. To harmonize what Judge Langhoff did and what the Court of Appeals did, I think that the appropriate way for the court to interpret these statutes is to indicate to the public, to the investors, to the business community of the state of Wisconsin, that if there is something coming up on the horizon for a limited liability company, that there should be notice given to the members of this particular issue. And the members who are conflicted, the ones that stand to gain personally from the transaction, should be required to disclose the potential conflict. And I think that fairness would require that they be allowed to vote only if the unconflicted members say so.
Well, then don't you have the minority member controlling the operation of the LLC?
Under these circumstances, you do. But I don't see how you avoid it unless you are going to open the door to allowing individuals to do as they please at the expense of the minority.
I think they have to be fair, and I have concerns about the price here, so I'm not taking that out of it. And I have concerns about the notice as well, but I don't see how we can interpret a statute in a way that permits the minority member to control LLCs. These entities are so informal. If you look at the documents here, it's two pieces of paper. One's a form piece of paper and the other one's not much better.
Well, the minority member's not controlling it. He might be preventing something from happening that is potentially detrimental to the LLC or to him.
Well, he's making the LLC do what he wants it to do, not what the majority wants it to do.
Well, the majority may have their own agenda.
They may.
That is contrary to the purpose for which the business was formed. But we don't want to forget that the original LLC is a party to this and that duties were owed to it by the two members that took its property away.
See, I don't think it has a duty to keep going in perpetuity, though. And that seems to be what your argument is, unless all agree that it doesn't go in perpetuity.
That is my argument. Because it was formed for that purpose, it should be allowed to continue to fulfill its purpose, unless there's something wrong, and there wasn't.
Mr. Conway, we're going around terms of majority and minority very loosely here. And I want to ask the question under 183.0404 sub 2, sub C. Unless otherwise provided in an operating agreement or this chapter, the affirmative vote, approval, or consent of all members shall be required to do any of the following, and that includes adopt, amend, or revoke an operating agreement.
Yes.
In this particular case, was there ever an amendment, revocation, or amendment or revocation of the original operating agreement by the majority? And if not, was it that opportunity provided either in the operating agreement itself or elsewhere in this chapter?
No, there was never anything like that that was done, Your Honor. But as long as you're on that section of the statute, I'd call your attention to subsection G of 404 sub 2, and that says that unanimous consent is required for any member to do any act on behalf of the limited liability company that contravenes an operating agreement. Now, we've opened another can of worms here. My time is almost up. But the operating agreement here was to operate this commercial real estate. And what they effectively did was terminate the existence of the original LLC by taking away its real estate. So it may also be a reasonable way to resolve this problem to say if you're going to take an action that results in the termination of the LLC by disposing of all of its assets, that unanimous consent should be required.
Well,
that, of course, takes us back to Justice Robinsack's issue about the tail wagging the dog, I guess, but, you know, the tail has a right to be on the dog.
Well, here there was no other agreement except these two sentences which said who was a member and how they were going to own the portions. They could have, they, being Gutsackers and Lanier, could have drafted an agreement which would have been followed by the LLC, but here, basically, the LLC is what is all we have to look at. But there could have been another agreement. In other words, you can draft.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes, right.
And you could have classes of voting,
right,
all,
right.
Non-voting members, all sorts of things. But that wasn't
the case. That wasn't the case here. Right.
So we've incorporated this chapter of the statutes by reference, without exception.
That's right.
If I want to sell, I'm a member of this LLC. I want to sell because I want the cash and need the cash. And another member doesn't want to sell because thinks that in the intermediate range it's going to make more money holding on. Do I have a conflict of interest?
Sure you do, because it's not your property. And your financial problems, with all due respect, Justice Abrahamson, are not the limited liability company's problems. Your remedy, if you want to cash out, would be to negotiate with the other member to buy your interest or to seek permission to bring in an outside investor to cash you out. Your personal...
I have 51% voting rights. Can I vote on that the way I just said?
I don't. My time is up. But no, Your Honor, I don't think you can, because now you're putting your interests ahead of that of the business.
Counsel, is that one? I have just one question.
Justice Wilcox.
Isn't another solution judicial dissolution under 183.0901 for the minority member if they come to a disagreement? I thought you stated that before.
Well, if that ever came to pass, certainly that is the remedy, but that was never an issue in this case because...
But it could have been and still could be. If there's a disagreement, just so I understand the law,
absolutely.
There's a disagreement and you're a minority, your option is to either duly sell it, whatever, or seek judicial dissolution.
So you have to meet the criteria for that.
Right.
There would have to be a deadlock in management.
Yep. All right. Okay.
Thank you.
Excuse me.
Justice Prosser.
Property went from one LLC to another LLC. Was that a taxable event?
To my knowledge, the amount of money shown on the... See, no money changed hands. There was essentially an assumption of debt by the new LLC, and the amount that they show... The only way we know what they claim to have paid is the amount shown on the real estate transfer tax return and on the deed. It was essentially the same amount that they paid for it, and there may be a problem with capital gains as it relates to... depreciation and so forth, Your Honor, but if that is a problem, and I don't know that it is or it isn't, but if it's a problem, it's a problem that I think should squarely be the problem of the people that perpetrated this.
Do we know who paid the real estate transfer fee?
Sure. It was paid by Julie Monnier and Paul Gottsack. Same people that paid the lawyers to do the paperwork. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Erickson?
Thank you. First of all, the last comment is not in the record, and I dispute the factual basis for that. But I do want to come back to something that Justice Butler raised. Mr. Conway got up here and said that the purpose of this LLC was to hold real estate long-term. You will not find that in the Articles of Organization. You will not find it in the Members' Agreement. And according to the section that Justice Butler referred to, there needs to be unanimous consent to amend those documents. And Mr. Conway argued strenuously to the trial court about the statute of frauds of LLCs and convinced Judge Langhoff on that issue, yet tries to claim that there's a specific purpose and that the transaction at issue was contrary to that purpose.
But in the record, there was testimony. It was intended to be a long-term investment. I'm talking about this is your appendix, page 38. So that was the testimony before the judge, right?
No, it could be that there were any number of intentions at given times as to various pieces of real estate, including the Wilson Avenue property. However, that doesn't mean that that's the purpose of this LLC. Also, there's this notice issue. If the legislature required notice, they would have put it in the statute, and they didn't. 183.0404 sub 1 sub A specifically says that the majority need only consent or approve. There is nothing in there whatsoever indicating that the majority needs to provide notice to a minority owner.
Erickson, the 183.0402 sub 1A does provide that a willful failure to deal fairly. Now, when you use that term, deal fairly, it seems to connote something more than just an end result. It's not talking about a fair result. It's talking about the way you deal with the limited liability company or its members. So to me, that suggests something a little bit more than result. It suggests a process as well. And if it does suggest a process, wouldn't that necessarily include notice?
I think this is one of the chicken and egg type arguments. I read this to mean the deal has to be fair. If you want to read it that the process has to be fair and you have an unfair process that results in a fair amount of money, then I still don't think you violated any statute. But there's nothing specifically that says deal fairly means or is defined as requiring notice.
Maybe I'm missing something. It doesn't say fair deal with deal being a noun. It says deal fairly with deal being a verb.
Oh,
am I missing something?
No, I'm interpreting my reading of this statute. I mean, if you are going to read that every time a minority owner or a majority owner does something that is morally or ethically or philosophically unfair, the minority owners will rule the day. And that's not the intent here. The majority is supposed to rule. And keep in mind, we're dealing with minimum standards. That's why I pointed out before that under 183.04.02 sub 3, you can add anything you want to an agreement. You can put in notice requirements. And the legislature reflects the fact that you can add other things to that. And Greg Gottsacker, in this case, didn't do that. He could have asked it to be a corporation and have all the formal requirements of a corporation. He didn't do that. So we're left with an LLC which has a purpose identified on the documents, and we have 75% of the ownership. And by the way, this is not a dividend of IBM. A K-1 specifically identifies the ownership interest, and those were exhibits at the time of trial, and it specifically says Greg Gottsacker's interest is 25%.
But there's a difference, maybe, between tax law, which is the K-1, and business law. And one of the issues, as I understand it, is that these LLCs were originally organized because of the tax code. And that the point of the LLC was to avoid the corporate double tax and to avoid the problems of a sub-C. Is it sub-C? It's been a long time since I've done this.
Sub-S, yeah.
Okay. And that this was going to be give you the limited liability of a partnership and at the same time give you the pass-through tax consequences, and that ultimately the tax code got changed, so a lot of this stuff probably should have been changed to reflect that, but that what you've got here is a animal that's designed to satisfy the tax code and the liability problems. So the K doesn't help you any, I don't think, because that is under the tax code, not who votes it and what the votes are entitled
to. The red light's on,
yes,
may I respond?
Yes.
The K-1 is one bit of evidence of how these parties treated these victims, together with how they handled the distribution relative to the Wilson Avenue property. And keep in mind, there is no dispute here as to the calculation of the equity in this case. It's the amount.
I suppose what they could have done was treat this between the two brothers as a partnership, 50% each. But then you would have wound up with the same K-1, but you may have had to file a partnership instead of a K-1.
And on the governance issues, there would have been
differences
as well.
In interpreting the word collectively, do we look to the statute at all?
The word comes from the members agreement prepared by an outside lawyer. And there really isn't any definition in 183 dealing with that or any other part of the statutes that I could find.
Doesn't use the word, does it?
The statute?
Yeah.
No.
So interpreting the word collectively, this is contract interpretation that is wholly separate from the statute. Is that fair? Is there really any dispute about that?
Well, the only way that the statute comes into play is when you look at 183.04.04 sub 1 sub A, which identifies each of the members' ability to vote and tracks it to their contribution. So in this case, we are relying on 184.04.04 sub 1 sub A in identifying a majority interest that voted in favor of this or approved it or consented to it, and that tracks the relative contributions of those members as well, which is reflected in the K-1s and the past experience and our belief in the interpretation of the dictionary definition. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Erickson, and thank you, Mr. Conway, for your discussion of 183 on limited liability. First time the court has had that issue before us. We appreciate the help you've given us. That concludes 03-0457 Gottsacker versus Monier. The students will remain here. Justice Wilcox will be out shortly. And the court is in recess until 1:30 when we will hear our third case for the day.